Hello, and welcome to New Books in Human Rights. This is Andrew Jaya. Today I'll be speaking with historian Lawrence Whitner, a now retired professor at the State University of New York in Albany, about his memoir, Working for Peace and Justice, Memoirs of an Activist Intellectual. As its title suggests, Whitner's book is a retrospective of a life and career that has straddled between academia and social engagement. While many scholars adopt a detached perspective, Whitner has strived to integrate his research with action. He has worked at seemingly every scale, on issues ranging from U.S. foreign policy to local labor relations. He has numerous noteworthy publications to his credit, including a three-volume study of the nuclear disarmament movement, entitled The Struggle Against the Bomb. Whitner's career as a public intellectual has carried him around the globe, making him a first-hand student of and frequent participant in events of historical importance. His memoir tells that story and is available through the University of Tennessee Press. This is Andrew Jaya, and I'm speaking with Professor Lawrence Whitner, who's written a new memoir called Working for Peace and Justice, Memoirs of an Activist Intellectual. Now, to begin our discussion today, I wanted to sort of start off with a moment that you present about two-thirds of the way through your book. In fact, you've had a very conventionally successful career in one respect. You've published extensively and importantly. You've studied at fantastic universities. And yet at the same time, there's this sort of unconventional aspect of your career as well, and that is your political activism. And there's this event in Albany that you sort of seize on, in which you participated in a demonstration, you were arrested. A colleague of yours remarked on this, and you said, you know, some people merely watch events and others participate in them. And I thought that this was a very remarkable thing for a professor of history to say.
Well, I think it reflected my view that historians are very good at describing the world, and I think I did that fairly well. But it's also true that historians as intellectuals sometimes want to change that world, or at least have some role in it. That is, they want to not only describe history, but to make history. And throughout my career, I tried to do both. I tried to describe some of the exciting events of my time, whether those were the struggles for racial justice or the peace movement or other dramatic campaigns. But at the same time, to participate in them, because I believed in social justice and in peace and more generally creating a better world. So I somehow managed to do both.
And this, I think, this aspect, or this sort of dual aspect of your career, sort of first crystallized when you were an undergraduate student at Columbia University. Where you sort of, you were both intellectually and politically awakened at the same time.
Yes, I come from a mildly liberal family, but there was no political activism involved beyond voting every few years. So I'd never, and my family had never been involved in any kind of social justice or peace movement. Nonetheless, I was very struck by the Columbia College core courses I was taking, the courses that dealt with the history of Western civilization and in Western thought, with intellectual history in the humanities courses and so on. And I began to understand that the knowledge that was being transmitted to me by my teachers had been hard won, that there had been a long struggle to pull humanity out of the muck of the grim past through the use of knowledge and reason and intellectual life. And I saw a connection between intellectual life, reason on the one hand, and humanity's progress on the other. in short, I came out of that with a rather conventional Enlightenment view of the world, that through knowledge and reason, a better world could be born, and I was determined to play my part, however small a part that might be, in bringing knowledge to bear on solving social problems.
And I think that sort of captures your sort of political sensibilities. You're in fact very pragmatic, or you see yourself as very pragmatic. You sort of eschew extremism in both directions.
Right. I'm not especially ideological, despite that statement I made earlier about changing the world. I was never really drawn into fantasies of revolution, or for that matter, into militarist fantasies or fantasies of the invisible hand of Adam Smith, economics, and so on. I believe the world could be changed, that those changes could be accomplished through the efforts of ordinary people, and particularly with intellectuals, providing ordinary people with the knowledge they could use to improve their society and their world.
Now, while an undergraduate at Columbia, you also made a very important friendship that I think carried you into some of your early political activity, and I was wondering if you could talk a bit about that.
Well, I made all kinds of new friends there. It was a very stimulating environment. There were all these bright people brought together in small classes for the most part. A particular friend of mine was my freshman roommate, Mike Weinberg, and we had a fine time together, both socially and ultimately politically. We both helped to form the Columbia College chapter of the Congress of Racial Equality, and we were also both involved in taking part in peace movement demonstrations, particularly against nuclear testing, which was a hot issue in the early 1960s. As was civil rights, of course.
And following your time at Columbia, you and Mike sort of swept up in the spirit of the time, I think, went on this sort of rambling road trip that was also, from what I understand, quite formative.
Yes. Well, we'd both read Jack Kerouac's novel On the Road, and like many young people at the time, we were fascinated by it and by the beat poets and so on. So we decided sometime during our college years that we were going to go on the road, too, in our case, after graduation. And so we did so. We drove 13,000 miles around the country, did all sorts of things from catching fish in the Pacific to doing migrant labor in the Northwest. And unlike many other people, we also put in some time as civil rights workers in the South that summer, in the summer of 1962, in both Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and in Jackson, Mississippi.
And some of the experiences, I guess we can come back and talk about this a bit later, but some of those experiences you had in the South perhaps foretold experiences you had later as a young professor. Could you maybe draw out, is there a particular event that you recall from that time in the South when you were there following your time at Columbia as an undergraduate that you thought tied in with your experience later as a young professor?
Well, to go back a bit, my father worked for a New York State agency, which was the first civil rights bureau since the Reconstruction period, called the New York State Commission Against Discrimination. It's now the New York State Division of Human Rights. And that agency was based on a law that had happened passed during the late 1940s that prohibited discrimination on the basis of race, religion, and national origin in employment. So I was sensitized during my youth to social and racial and religious discrimination. So it wasn't surprising that during college I would be caught up in the civil rights movement. But during college, I guess during my senior year, when we were involved in the Columbia Corps chapter, a Corps field secretary named Ronnie Moore had come up to visit civil rights supporters in the North, and Ronnie told us about the struggle in the South, particularly in Baton Rouge, where he and three other students had been expelled from Southern University, a traditionally African-American college, for doing voter registration work, or at least trying to do it. Obviously, the authorities were blocking it at every turn. And they were arrested under an old anti-syndicalist law that had been passed against the IWW during the early 20th century when it was organizing timber workers in Louisiana. And it provided for a hefty fine and a hefty prison term at hard labor for criminal anarchy, which was what the authorities had arrested these voter registration civil rights workers for. So when Ronnie was up in the North, he asked us, Well, we came up to him after his talk, and we told him, Ronnie, you're doing a great job, and if there's any way we can help out, please let us know. And he said, well, what are you boys doing this summer? So we said, well, we're going on the road, as a matter of fact. And we explained what that meant. And he said, well, is there any chance you might come through Baton Rouge? And we said, sure, we could arrange that. And so we did. We got there in late July, and we helped out in that small city. And then we drove on north to Jackson, where we did voter registration work out of the local Freedom House. We also attended a Corps SNCC field secretary's meeting that was held at the Freedom House there in Jackson. On the way there, though, on the trip between Baton Rouge and Jackson, we nearly got ourselves killed. We nearly preceded Goodman, Cheney, and Schwerner in getting ourselves murdered by local white racists. We had stopped at a gas station on the way. It was, of course, a very low-budget trip since we were on the road a la Jack Kerouac. And so we had a quarrel with the gas station attendant whose sign on the road indicated a lower gas price than was on the gas pump. And he was threatening to kill us and to drag us out of the car and so on. And we narrowly averted getting killed there. But we did move on to Jackson. The voter registration work was, of course, done in the same bailiwick as Medgar Evers was doing it 2 years later when one year later when he was murdered by local racists for doing the same thing a few miles down the road.
Now, after that experience when you were on the road and sort of engaging in some of your early political activism, you came back and you decided that you were going to apply to graduate school. And from what I understand, you were looking in graduate school for a sort of balance between, you know, the intellectual and the activist sort of development or path or progress that you've been making up to that point. And that led you ultimately to the University of Wisconsin.
Yes, at that time, well, I'd I'd taken a course in which I'd read a book by Merle Curdy, taken a course during my Columbia days. And Merle Curdy was, at the time, one of the most distinguished American historians. He was a former president of the American Historical Association, a former president of the Organization of American Historians, and the founder of the field of U.S. intellectual history and of U.S. social history. And as I later learned, he was also a founder of the field of peace history, the study of peace movements and peace activism in the United States. And studying with Curdy, I was struck again by the connection between intellectual life, between doing cutting-edge intellectual work on the one hand, and cutting-edge social change. Curdy and I had some conversations about the civil rights movement and peace movement and so on. And in fact, at one point, he even mentioned that since the late 1930s, there had been no significant scholarly works that had been done on the history of the U.S. peace movement. And so I picked up that that theme when later I was a doctoral student at Columbia. I'd gone back to Columbia University for my doctoral work. And I picked up that theme, and I looked around, and I realized that in terms of my doctoral dissertation, things were wide open for writing about the history of the U.S. peace movement since the 1930s. So I eventually turned to that dissertation topic. I wrote my dissertation on that subject, and that became my first book entitled Rebels Against War.
And you sort of, as a result of honing in on peace movements, becoming a historian and a scholar of peace movements, you sort of, to track back to the story that we began the discussion with, you became a sort of observer of the very same sorts of movements that you were participating in at the same time.
Yes, absolutely. And in fact, I found it very exciting to be doing my dissertation work. I wasn't at all bored with it. I couldn't wait to get up in the morning, and I couldn't stop working at night, since I felt I was doing really important work. I was outlining for historians and for the general public the history of this social movement that by the mid and late 60s was out in the streets and was challenging the Vietnam War and more broadly the general direction of U.S. foreign policy. Sometimes I'd take a little break and I'd go off to a peace demonstration. At other times I was interviewing some of the leading peace movement activists in the United States, people ranging from Norman Thomas to A.J. Musty to David McReynolds and Dave Dellinger and others. And it was all very exciting and all part of a general blend of intellectual activity and movement activity.
You'll often hear in graduate schools that it's important for scholars to maintain a sort of dispassionate objectivity about the subject matter of their study. Did you ever find that balance difficult?
Not really. Frequently, the people that I soon met who were studying comparable things and doing comparable things, blending intellectual life and peace movement work, frequently we were criticized for not being objective. And my response to the critics and to those who have made that charge since that time is that there was no reason for us to be inaccurate in our findings or subjective. There was every reason for us to be objective because we wanted the truth out. We wanted to tell the full story of what had happened, so as better better understand what had happened, and to transform the world. And you can't do that based on myths. You can do that based on knowledge. So like the Enlightenment thinkers who were my heroes and heroines, I believed, and I think other peace researchers believed, that by doing a good job as peace researchers, we could better train and arm, if I can use that term, the peace movement and peace-minded people to secure a more peaceful world. So I never saw a contradiction between supporting a social movement and doing a good job studying it. Just as I don't see any contradiction between being a good biologist and studying the AIDS phenomenon and trying to get rid of it. Obviously, a good biologist wouldn't falsify his or her findings, and I certainly never falsified mine.
So it goes back to this kernel, this idea that essentially the way to solve social problems is to integrate knowledge with action.
Absolutely. I may, in fact, be too much of a believer in the role of knowledge in assisting humanity in building a better world. But nonetheless, that's my belief. And I think underpinning most education, that belief is there as well. That is, most college teachers and teachers in the lower grades as well, I think, don't just believe that education will help students get better jobs, but rather that education will help students lead better lives.
Maybe that's a good segue to begin talking about your first academic appointment at the Hampton Institute in the South. That from with the stories that you tell about that, it seems like it was sort of fraught with sort of friction with the community and with social importance as well.
Yes, well, not surprisingly, I accepted my first job at Hampton Institute, now Hampton University, a traditionally African American college in the South. And Hampton is located in Hampton, Virginia, which at that time, when I taught there, 1967-68, was a thoroughly segregated community, dominated by white racism, and no particular respect or love for Hampton Institute, this largely black institution in the town's midst. I was actually turned down for housing on racial grounds when I got there. My wife and I tried to rent a place, but as soon as I indicated that I was going to be teaching at Hampton Institute, suddenly we were told that the apartment we were trying to rent had been taken, and therefore there was no chance of our moving in there. Eventually, we did find housing, and we fit into a community in rather odd ways. On the one hand, we were very very welcomed as white faculty at Hampton Institute, since black colleges needed all the help they could get, especially from whites in their beleaguered situation in the South. And on the other hand, of course, we were viewed as very strange ducks or as subversives by the local white society. And of course, 1967-68 was a hot time in terms of the racial justice struggle in the United States. Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated during that year, and there were big demonstrations in Hampton that I took part in, mostly with black students, a handful of whites, and thousands of black students marching through downtown Hampton. And also, of course, Martin Luther King Jr.'s Poor People's Campaign, prior to his death, came through Hampton, Virginia. And friends and I served as marshals when it came through the nearby city of Norfolk, Virginia. We were supposed to keep white racists back in case they attacked the line of march. As it turned out, they didn't do so. I was very glad of that. There were other ventures too. We ran a third party campaign for the Peace and Freedom Party, which we got on the Virginia ballot. At the time, we were planning to have a third-party ticket of Martin Luther King Jr. and Benjamin Spock for president and vice president, respectively. But after King's assassination, we switched to the black comedian Dick Gregory, who was a sharp social critic, and Dr. Spock as our presidential vice presidential ticket. And we were the only southern state to field that ticket that year.
You also related this story, or just a brief anecdote, about the effect you had on a particular colleague, that you encouraged this colleague at the Hampton Institute to become more politically active. And this was actually an important moment in his life, it sounds like, that it impressed his family, that he had sort of transformed from someone who was sort of disengaged to someone who had become engaged.
Yes, well, the odd part about the Hampton constituency was that many of the senior faculty were older African Americans, and while they certainly supported civil rights, living for years, sometimes for decades, sometimes having grown up in a segregationist white supremacist culture, they had learned to be very cautious. They didn't often stick their necks out. They wouldn't have survived long had they done so. On the other hand, there was a whole wave of new young white faculty like me who had just come in there that year or in the last couple of years, and they were young PhDs from Berkeley and Columbia and Harvard and Michigan and Wisconsin and so on, and they'd been involved in more dramatic, more daring struggles against the Vietnam War. They'd been involved in sit-ins against racism and so on, and they had come from outside, and now they were down in the South, and like me, they were bursting with energy and wanted to transform things. So there was a little bit of tension there, not total tension, but the older black faculty were somewhat more cautious than we were. In any case, what happened in the instance you mentioned was that one of the senior black faculty had really not been sticking his neck out very far, but we encouraged him to support King's Poor People's March, and he became one of the organizers for the campus. That is, some of the younger, more militant white faculty did so, and he agreed to do so too, finally. And later on, he thanked one of my young colleagues for pushing him in that direction, since when he told his mother, his aging mother, about this, she was absolutely delighted and said to him that she always knew he would turn out this way. So I guess we helped to inject a little liveliness perhaps more gumption into some of the more accommodating black faculty, although there were black faculty who were not as accommodating either and who were in the movement barricades at that time.
Following your time at the Hampton Institute, you ended up at a very, very different sort of institution, that being Vassar. And there you continued to engage in your sort of political activity, and again found friction, but a different sort of friction than I think you found at the Hampton Institute.
Yes, Vassar was a very different sort of place. The tone was upper middle class to upper class. The faculty was, for the most part, pretty hidebound, and of course the whole student body and faculty were overwhelmingly white and relatively privileged. And in fact, for the first year or so, the student body was female. They only gradually admitted males, and then finally sought to get male attendance up to roughly half of the entering freshman class. So it was a different sort of experience. And on the one hand, Vassar seemed to be not only more genteel, but more liberal and tolerant. But on the other, by the late 60s and early 70s, many of the older faculty and certainly the administration were backlashing against the trends of social protest at the time. And so the younger faculty, like me, were pushing against that stodginess and that elitism. And ultimately, when we were engaging in the moratorium campaigns, having faculty shut down their classes in protest against the Vietnam War, or when we supported the establishment of a Black Studies program on the campus, or other campaigns along those lines, the more conservative faculty and administration cracked down on us, and they began firing the dissident faculty, and ultimately purged a substantial portion of the dissidents, including me.
Yeah, in fact, when you came up for tenure, you found your path blocked.
Yes, yes. By that point, I had published a very widely praised monograph, Rebels Against War, an edited book, a slew of scholarly articles. My teaching evaluations were very good. I had a lot of students, but nonetheless, the old guard faculty were determined to get rid of me as a wave maker. The tenured faculty, who were the only ones who could vote on me, split. The majority, who were conservatives, all voted against me, and the minority, who were liberals, voted for me. And so I was turned down for tenure, and I moved on in later years to teaching under the Fulbright program, and also finally to teaching at SUNY Albany, where I gradually rose to be a professor of history.
Now, this time when you were teaching under the Fulbright program, I thought it sort of opened another sort of aspect to your career, which is this international dimension. And you said that when you were in Japan, something that you found sort of uncomfortable or strange was that you were sort of treated as almost a dignitary, while at the same time in the U.S. you felt sort of closed out from academic life. And I wondered if you could talk about that sort of feeling of displacement a bit.
Well, I couldn't speak Japanese, for one thing, beyond a few key phrases that I learned for the occasion. I didn't know much about Japanese history, although I did know a good deal about the U.S. occupation of Japan, since I'd studied General Douglas MacArthur as one of the scholarly foci for my work. But more than that, the Vietnam War was still raging, and I was often viewed by many Japanese as a symbol of the United States, and particularly of the United States government. And I was a critic of that government, certainly when it came to the Vietnam War, and more broadly as to U.S. foreign policy at that time. And therefore, it was an uncomfortable situation for me. On the other hand, just to expand on that last point a bit, some students would come up to me, recognizing me as a foreigner, a white Westerner there in Japan, and they would say to me, "They were so glad the United States was in Vietnam, fighting for freedom and so on," and I'd be forced to tell them, "Well, I'm not for that." That fight, and I didn't think it was a fight for freedom. And then, on the other hand, there'd be many, many Japanese students who were demonstrating against the Vietnam War and against the United States' role in that war. There were times when I would come to campus by subway and walk to campus and start going onto the campus grounds, and I would have to walk through a gauntlet of masked Japanese students carrying big black and red flags on poles, and they were from sectarian Marxist-Leninist groups, the revolutionary this and the revolutionary workers that, and so on. And at least superficially, they were hostile to me, and I was pretty clearly a Westerner coming onto their campus. What could happen to me? It wasn't quite clear. I wasn't quite sure what I should say or try to say to them if I was suddenly attacked. But in fact, I was not. The Japanese student groups were more hostile to one another than they were to Westerners. And I had a fine time there in Japan. I even hooked up not just with anti-war Japanese, but with a group of Westerners called the Committee of Concerned Asian Scholars. And we met with U.S. soldiers, with GIs from the carrier Midway, and talked to them in off-base coffee houses, and discussed the war and discussed the need for changing U.S. foreign policy.
Now, you said something which I think makes a good, leads us into another discussion about your political activities when you were back in the States. Once you had found a place at SUNY Albany, you became, again, as you were everywhere, engaged in political action and began to notice that you said that the Japanese students were sort of more hostile to one another than they were to outsiders. You also observed that many sort of issue-oriented groups in the States were sort of more wrapped up in their own infighting than they were in sort of targeting the sort of common sources, the sources of, I guess, sort of targeting the common problems that they all observed.
Yeah, well, unfortunately, in my view, that is one of the problems that the left faces in the United States. And I don't just mean, very small left groups, communist groups, socialist groups, and so on, but broader groups, ranging from women's groups to labor groups to peace movement groups to environmental groups, they tend to focus on their own particular cause, sometimes to the exclusion of other causes. So single issue politics can divide them. And of course, more than that, there are ideological differences. Certainly, in the socialist and communist camps, not only long-term hostilities between socialists and communists, but also even within those separate realms, there would be differences of opinion. Socialists, for example, might back a third party, or they might back working inside the Democratic Party, or they might be more anti-communist or less anti-communist, or a whole range of things that can divide them. So often, the social change forces in the United States have been divided and remain divided. I often saw my role as trying to provide a more mainstream approach. I always liked the speeches and writings of the late Michael Harrington. who said that if you really want social justice and peace, you should be on the left wing of the possible. And what he meant by that was that rather than go off with some little obscure sectarian group, you should be in there with mainstream groups, being a force there that would pull them leftward, that would give them that broader social consciousness they would need. So that I became involved in the labor movement, for example, at a time when many leftists in the United States had nothing to do with the labor movement. They viewed it as stodgy and traditional and right-wing and backlashing and so on. Well, I viewed it as a potential force for change if its consciousness of class divisions could be heightened, and if its understanding of the abuses of capitalism could be heightened. And in terms of the peace movement, too, I didn't see that movement as a movement that should be anti-American as such, or assume that the only militarism and the only crimes in the world were on the part of the United States. As a historian, I could clearly see that militarism was a worldwide phenomenon. It had gone back thousands of years, and that it should be combated. So I try to take a broader humanistic approach in these movements and to push these movements toward a sharper confrontation with those who I felt were the real foe, the militarists, the exploiters of workers, the exploiters of women, the sexists, and so on, the despoilers of the environment, and hopefully draw people together into a broad social movement, or at least a number of broad social movements that could contest successfully for power.
Now, despite not adhering to any particular, you're not an ideologue, you're not an extremist, you're a pragmatist. You still ended up drawing the attention, and I found this very striking. You're ended up one of the potential targets of the Unabomber because he saw you, for whatever reason, as sort of in opposition to his worldview.
Yes, that was very strange, really. I'd become a leading writer, maybe the leading writer, on the campaign for nuclear disarmament, the broad movement to roll back the nuclear arms race and create a nuclear weapons-free world. In fact, I'd written several prize-winning books on that subject. Occasionally I would be phoned by journalists who would ask me for my views on anti-nuclear demonstrations or on broader questions that had to do with the nuclear arms race. And one time I was called by a journalist for the San Francisco Examiner and asked about the Unabombers, since the Unabomber was a critic of modern science. And I was, of course, dealing with other kinds of critics of modern science, those who were critics of the nuclear arms race. In my conversation with that journalist, I made a distinction between the critique that nuclear disarmers made of the nuclear arms race and the much more hostile view that the Unabombers seem to have of modern science and technology. Therefore, I wasn't totally surprised when after a fellow named Theodore Kaczynski was arrested as the Unabomber, the FBI contacted me and asked me, why did I think that this fellow Kaczynski, who they were pretty sure it was a Unabomber, had my name and address in his little book. And I at first I didn't know, but I quickly figured it out, that of course he was looking at mass media stories that would feature him, and I had been one of his critics, and therefore I was probably being targeted for a future bomb. And the FBI warned me to be on lookout for packages that might still arrive, since he might have mailed it in the past. And I did so, but then no bomb ever reached me.
Now, this is perhaps a poor transition, but I thought maybe it would be a good, this is a good chance to talk about one of your major works, the trilogy, The Struggle Against the Bomb. Maybe you could talk about the inception of the work and how it was received at first. And it's taken a while for it to sort of taken up by the sort of academic community, but eventually it has gained quite a bit of momentum.
Oh yes. Well, I began it in the midst of the great anti-nuclear campaign of the 1980s, the campaign against Reagan and Thatcher and Brezhnev and their talk of nuclear war and their nuclear arms buildups at the time. And I had studied peace movement, but this was natural for me in many ways. This mass movement that had turned out more people in demonstrations than any, as far as I could tell, than any previous social movement. A million people, for example, in New York City's Central Park in June of 1982. So I wrote on this movement, but I began it with the assumption that the movement had failed, since at that point the movement did seem to have failed. There was no progress toward rolling back the nuclear arms race, and these major figures were still snarling at one another and leading us toward nuclear war. But as I dug into the files of the various governments, the one secret files of the White House and of the National Security Council and the Secretary of State and the British Foreign Office and the Central Committee of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, what I found was that these governments were very worried about these anti-nuclear campaigns and had trimmed their sails. They had backed off from nuclear war. And they had backed off from the nuclear arms race at key points, and indeed they soon would again. That is, Reagan and Gorbachev soon moved to talking about a nuclear-free world, a total turnabout for Reagan, certainly. So when the book finally came out, I had some very dramatic evidence of not just the massive nature of the movement, but also its efficacy in transforming the foreign policy of the nuclear powers and in preventing non-nuclear powers from developing nuclear weapons.
And then your work on this, on that trilogy, in fact, brought you back to Japan eventually. You were invited back to speak on the topic of nuclear disarmament, and while they're also engaged in some political activity as well.
Yes. I've been to Japan a number of times. One of the times was to go back there in 2004 to deliver some academic lectures, including one at Hiroshima City University, where the panel of us, the lecturers, were invited to the mayor's mansion, where we were wined and dined, and we had champagne out in the garden served by liveried waiters. But I combined that, as usual, with political activism too. I was asked by Gens Suiken, the Japan Congress Against Atomic and Hydrogen Bombs, to give some lectures for that anti-nuclear group, which I did. And I was also asked to come on out. Well, first I was asked to speak at a press conference there that the Japan Congress had organized, and I did so, talking to journalists from newspapers comparable to the New York Times and the Washington Post and so on. I never get interviewed by them here, but I was there. And furthermore, I was rushed from that press conference to the annual march through Hiroshima's streets by anti-nuclear demonstrators at the anniversary of the Hiroshima bombing. And I got there. Our taxi pulled up to the line of marchers, and I said, "Where do you want me to march?" And he said, "Right in front. You're going to be holding the banner." So I did go up in front, and I took my portion of the banner, and we strode through Hiroshima streets, thousands of us, with a sound truck preceding us, with police holding back the cheering crowds. It was a great day.
And in fact, I think there's a very nice picture of you in the book holding that banner at the front of the parade. Yes, yeah. Now, before I think we're drawing a bit to a close, but something we haven't talked a lot about is sort of the personal side of your life. And there's a lot of personal detail in your memoir. Your family sort of has evolved and gone through some periods of transition all the while you're advancing through your career and engaging as a political intellectual.
In general, I had a fine time as a activist intellectual, but nonetheless, it definitely put strains on my family life. It put strains on my job security when I was effectively purged from academia, although I eventually worked myself back into it in the United States. Nonetheless, it was a very exciting life too. Wonderful friends along the way in social justice groups, in civil rights groups, in my union, United University Professions, in Peace Action, the nation's largest peace group, on whose national board I now serve. So in many ways, I enjoyed being an activist intellectual, and despite the family and job stresses and strains, this role provided a good life for me, and I only hope it's helped others in some small ways to create a better world.
All the while, again, there's yet more detail in your book about, I think, your sense of, you've sort of honed in on and focused in on some very, very serious issues in your professional and your professional career and in your career as an activist. But you've also maintained a good sense of humor and a sense of sort of appreciation for things like music as well.
Well, I hope so. Most people consider me a very good-humored, even irreverent sort of person, and I think I am. Probably if I had more reverence for the established verities, I wouldn't be rebelling against them. But as a historian especially, I've learned that today's respected tradition is tomorrow's subject for the scrap heap, so that I've tried to keep that in mind, that history is a study of change over time, and therefore one might as well have a sense of humor about these revered things, although I guess I revere some things too, but I don't laugh about them quite as much. Furthermore, I found that music was not only a way to integrate politics into a different format, but was very satisfying. I learned to play guitar along the way, and later banjo, and for perhaps the last 10 or 15 years, I've been performing with a musical group called the Solidarity Singers, and we perform at union picket lines and at peace movement meetings and environmental groups, press conferences, and this sort of thing. And it's a lot of fun for us, really, and it develops a different side of me, perhaps a different portion of my brain, that enjoys doing this sort of thing, and I think reaches people on a different level than intellectual discussions or, for that matter, political harangues.
Do you have any other projects in the workings that we should be looking out for?
Well, I'm now writing a novel, as a matter of fact, and it has to do with the subject of the corporatization of the university and resistance to it. I think it's quite humorous. It's meant to be satirical. It's a very different thing than I've done in the past. And if any potential publishers are out there who might like to publish a satirical novel about university life, they should feel free to contact me.
Well, very good. We'll have to keep our eye out for that.
Thank you.
Well, Professor Whitner, thank you very much for your time. It's been very interesting speaking with you today.
Okay. Thank you very much.
This has been Andrew Jaya for New Books in Human Rights, part of the New Books Network. I've been speaking with historian Paul Friedland about his book Seeing Justice Done, The Age of Spectacular Capital Punishment in France. It will be available via Oxford University Press starting in July 2012. Thanks for listening.